This is VOA's International Edition. Going up, Iraq's political crisis deepens as the U.S. continues humanitarian airdrops. The Israelis and Hamas Palestinians begin a new truce. South Korea proposes talks with the North. Authorities in Sierra Leone impose large fines for failure to report cases of Ebola. And teenagers playing violent games, a study finds, are more likely to engage in high-risk behavior.
You're rewarded for doing aggressive things, and then that, in a very straightforward learning kind of model, leads you to subsequently behave aggressively in real life.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Iraq's highest court has ruled that Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's coalition is the largest in parliament, giving a boost to his bid to stay in the post he has held since 2006. The court issued its decision today, hours after Mr. Maliki announced he was filing a lawsuit against President Fouad Massoum for failing to nominate a new prime minister. Meanwhile, as VOA's Victor Beatty reports, the United States continues humanitarian airdrops to civilians trapped by Sunni militants in northern Iraq.
Prime Minister Maliki, who was serving in a caretaker capacity since April's election, signaled in a Sunday night televised speech his intention to seek a third term in office and denounce President Massoum. The Prime Minister said Mr. Massoum violated the Constitution by failing to meet a deadline for naming a new head of government and had failed to ask Parliament's largest bloc, Mr. Maliki's State of Law Coalition, to nominate a Prime Minister for the sake of political calculations. A parliamentary session to discuss a new Iraqi government has been postponed to August 19th. Meanwhile, media reports said special forces units loyal to the Prime Minister were deployed in strategic areas of the capital, Baghdad. Speaking Monday in Sydney, Australia, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said formation of a new Iraqi government is critical for stability and urged Mr. Maliki to refrain from stoking political tensions further.
We believe that the government formation process is critical in terms of sustaining stability and calm in Iraq. And our hope is that Mr. Maliki will not stir those waters. One thing all Iraqis need to know, that there will be little international support of any kind whatsoever for anything that deviates from the legitimate constitutional process that is in place and being worked on now. They need to finish that and give a new government an opportunity to be voted on and move forward.
RAND Corporation analyst Patrick Johnston says it's another sign that Mr. Maliki is more interested in maintaining his own position than confronting the challenges facing his country.
It's just kind of the most rash and brazen form of misbehavior and kind of political conflict that we've seen from Prime Minister Maliki. The corruption, the negligence in terms of developing the security services, as we've seen the Islamic State go on the offensive and take over, you know, large chunks of the country. Maliki's been primarily focused on keeping his own job and maintaining his grasp on power.
U.S. officials and many Western analysts say Prime Minister Maliki, a Shia, has failed to unify the divided country since taking office. They describe him as increasingly unacceptable to Iraq's Sunni Muslims, to Kurds, and to many of his fellow Shia. Appearing Sunday on U.S. television, Senate Armed Services Committee member Jack Reed of Rhode Island said the advance of Sunni radicals in northern Iraq is a result of a failure of leadership by Mr. Maliki in Baghdad.
In order to put the situation right, we have to begin at the fundamental core, which is leadership in Baghdad, Iraqi leadership, which will work together in a unified way to defend and protect their country and defeat ISIS.
The militant Islamist State group has taken advantage of Iraq's political crisis to extend its control over predominantly Sunni territory in northern Iraq, declaring an Islamist caliphate and creating what the International Organization of Migration says is more than 1 million internally displaced people. Following President Obama's announcement of limited U.S. involvement Thursday in forestalling a genocide of minority Yazidis and Christians, the U.S. military said it's conducting another airdrop of food and water to thousands of Yazidis trapped on Mount Sinjar and threatened by the militants. France and Britain are also involved in the humanitarian response. U.S. forces also carried out a new round of airstrikes Sunday, destroying trucks and a mortar position used by militants firing on Kurdish forces near Erbil. Congressman Peter King, a Republican member of the House Homeland Security Committee, criticized the U.S. response as inadequate, saying the Islamic State group poses a direct threat to the United States.
This isn't Iraq we're talking about. We can't wait for Maliki or the Iraqi parliament to fight ISIS. Every day that goes by, ISIS builds up this caliphate, and it becomes a direct threat to the United States of America. They are more powerful now than al-Qaeda was on 9/11.
King says he supports what he calls massive and sustained U.S. air attacks against the Islamic State fighters, as well as aggressively arming the Kurds. Kurdish Peshmerga forces Sunday said they retook two towns from militants, with a Kurdish spokesman attributing their success to U.S. aerial strikes. RAND Corporation's Johnston calls it a surprising development.
Although they're known for having fairly competent and strong Peshmerga militia, they responded in a way that was much like the Iraqi security forces, reportedly as ISIS advanced into Kurdish territory and largely abandoned the fight rather than pursuing it.
Johnston says the future effectiveness of Kurdish forces to defend against the Sunni militants remains unpredictable. In an Associated Press interview, Masoud Barzani, president of the semi-autonomous Kurdish regional government, said U.S. military support has been effective, but called for more heavy weapons, not U.S. troops, to defeat the militants. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Pope Francis at the Vatican Sunday spoke about Iraq before a crowd of thousands packed into St. Peter's Square.
The news arriving from Iraq leaves us in disbelief and dismay.
And as we've been reporting, the militants' insurgency in northern Iraq has forced thousands to flee for their lives. The Pope says the refugees are dying of hunger and thirst.
Donne sequestrate.
Women seized, people massacred, violence of every kind, destruction everywhere, destruction of houses and places of religious, historical, and cultural heritage. All this seriously offends God and seriously offends humanity.
Di patrimoni religiosi, storici e culturali.
The Pope thanked those bringing relief to the victims. He said he had faith in an eventual political solution there and is sending a personal envoy to Iraq today. Israel and Hamas have begun a new 72-hour ceasefire, giving the warring sides another chance to negotiate a lasting end to a month of fighting that has left 2,000 people dead. Egypt mediated the truce that went into effect early today and is hosting delegations from both sides for talks in Cairo. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon welcomed the ceasefire and expressed strong hope that Israel and Hamas could agree to halt the conflict for the sake of all civilians. He also said the UN is ready to assist in implementing any agreement that brings peace and a chance for much-needed reconstruction and development of Gaza. An earlier 72-hour ceasefire expired Friday with no progress toward a long-term truce. Egypt mediated that break in fighting as well, but it ended with Hamas resuming its rocket attacks on Israel and the Israeli military carrying out new airstrikes in Gaza. VOA correspondent Scott Bobb has been traveling within the Gaza region to get a sense of what the civilians are enduring. Today he spoke with us after visiting a kibbutz near Gaza.
On the first day of this latest ceasefire, it's calm here. But people are still very, very wary. This kibbutz had normally 400 people living in it. All the families, the children have left. Just a few people are here taking care of the dairy farm and the fields. But the activity has slowed down tremendously. And they say that their fields have been seriously damaged by all the tanks and military activity over the last month. They're waiting to see, they say, many of them, that they'll only come back if there's a permanent ceasefire or some sort of assurance of their security. The tunnels worry them a lot, and the rockets, of course, have taken their toll.
Do any of these people talk about their future? Do they have dreams for what's going to happen to them, or are they just fleeing?
Well, at this kibbutz, they're having a big weekend reunion, and everyone's coming back during this lull to talk about that. And some of the young families are wondering if they have a future here, if this is going to just continue, is it just part of a cycle? And they don't want to raise their children in this kind of atmosphere, and the elders agree. Others are committed for either ideological or personal reasons to living here. I just spoke with the former mayor of Sderot, who is basically saying, we have nowhere else to go, so we're staying no matter what. And there are some that have that attitude. And then others say they would just like to find peace and some sort of arrangement, and would like to see their government do that. At the moment, public sentiment mostly is very angry and rather hard against the Hamas movement in Gaza for the amount of damage and the loss of lives in this part of Israel. There are other parts where it's a little bit different, but it's still a period of uncertainty and wait and see.
I was going to ask you about Hamas. Why are people not leaving Hamas in groves?
Some will tell you that it's hard for them to leave. They may not support them, but they can't speak out against them too strongly or risk some sort of retaliation. It's not a democratic institution. That's well known. And as a result, they have their supporters, but the many people who do not support them are afraid to speak out. And, of course, there hasn't been an election since the one that brought Hamas to power, so there's no way of voting with a ballot box. So it's a bit of a limbo for those people.
I was speaking to an analyst last week, and he said that the situation there, it might end up in Hamas losing control of where they are in Gaza.
Well, they don't seem likely to, from my perspective at this time. There's no popular uprising in the making that could topple them, and Israel has shown how far it's willing to go, and it's not far enough to topple Hamas because of the collateral damage, the euphemism for loss of civilian life. So at the moment, I don't see it, but maybe wiser heads do from their perspective.
What about living conditions where you are?
Well, in terms of supplies and so forth, nothing has changed too much. They say the Israeli economy could suffer about a 0.5% decline because of this conflict. They have said it's going to cost about $5 billion. The Palestinians say it's cost their economy something like $5 billion. Life goes on, but many people have moved north from here temporarily. They're living in with extended family or friends, and of course it's not a stable existence, and the children are not happy. They miss their homes, and as do most people. So it's not a pleasant environment, although they're, in terms of comforts, it's certainly better than in Gaza. But it's not a normal life, and just what they're upset about.
Any thoughts about the international community getting more involved in this situation?
Well, one of the things that you hear a lot from especially the people in Gaza is, why aren't they? Why are not the European and American and Arab nations coming to their help? The answer, of course, is that it's hard to mount a humanitarian effort while there's fighting and uncertainty. On the Israeli side, they don't understand, or the people that support this operation, why there's been such criticism in the international community of the operation against Hamas. And so everyone sees it from their perspective and seems to think that the international community has some sort of ability to solve the world's problems very easily, which of course is not true.
VOA correspondent Scott Bobb.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
In Sierra Leone, tribal authorities are imposing large fines for failure to report cases of Ebola, which has claimed nearly 1,000 lives in West Africa in the worst outbreak of the disease in four decades. Some 1,500 soldiers and police have been deployed to enforce quarantines, turning people away at checkpoints and accompanying health workers searching for people who may have contracted the virus. Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea are the countries hardest hit by the epidemic, which the World Health Organization has called an international health emergency. Dr. Kiji Fukuda is WHO's Assistant Director General. He appeared Sunday on the U.S. TV program CBS Face the Nation.
This is definitely an outbreak that can be contained. We know that this is not a mysterious disease. It's a severe disease, but we know it's not mysterious. And what I mean by that is that we know how this virus is transmitted. You know, it requires one person touching another person and coming into contact with bodily fluids. And because of that, and we know when people are most infectious, this virus can be stopped. But what's difficult in this situation is that we're dealing with countries with weak health systems, and we're dealing with areas in which practices like good infection prevention and control practices are not the norm in some of the hospitals and in families and communities. And so what we need here is really to scale up. And so we know what to do, but WHO, working with many different countries and many different partner organizations, need help in making sure that we can do the things which are needed to stop transmission.
West Africa has been counting the cost of what it will take to contain the Ebola outbreak as unprecedented restrictions cause problems at airports and other transportation centers. Burkina Faso became the latest African country to announce stringent airport health checks and border controls. There also are growing problems with food shortages and rapidly increasing prices. Robin Sanders is a former U.S. ambassador to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, as well as Nigeria. She appeared Sunday on the U.S. TV program ABC This Week.
The civil aviation authorities, as well as the border patrol authorities across all of the countries that are affected, need to communicate better. They need to ensure that they are not only quarantining, but having zones of movement. I think one of the things that gets left out of this discussion in terms of how the virus gets into the human population is a food security issue. And you're facing that now in Liberia, where people are quarantined. They were not told in advance, and therefore there are food shortages in those same areas. How the virus sometimes gets into the population is that people are food insecure, so they eat bushmeat, rodents that are affected with the virus.
The World Health Organization says clinical trials of vaccines against Ebola should begin soon. South Korea sent a message to the North proposing a high-level meeting to discuss mutual interests, including reunions of families separated by the Korean War. The message today suggested August 19th as the date for talks at the truce village of Panmunjom. In most recent family reunions held in February were the first in more than 3 years. South Korean President Park Geun-hye has proposed that the two rivals hold regularly scheduled reunions because time is running out for the elderly people separated by politics and the early 1950s war. There have been several reunions since they first began in 1985, but their frequency has fluctuated depending on the state of Korean relations.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook, VOA Asia.
Teenagers who play violent, risk-glorifying video games are more likely to engage in high-risk behaviors, according to a new study by Dartmouth College. Jay Hull is chair of the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department at the New Hampshire School.
So the most interesting and kind of new aspect of the study is that instead of focusing on aggression, which is typically done in the literature, so people are interested in, do playing violent games result or is associated with subsequent increases in aggression? What we focused on was a general deviance hypothesis, with the idea that if you're playing games in which you're doing things, playing a deviant character or a character who has antisocial values, that you're more likely to do a broad variety of deviant things. We were particularly interested in looking at health risk behaviors. So my colleague, James Sargent, over in Geisel Medical School, has been studying health risk in adolescents for quite a while, and I've been collaborating with him on those studies for about 10 years. And what we were particularly interested in was adolescent drinking, and especially binge drinking, cigarette smoking, risky sexual behaviors, so having sex with multiple partners, not using protection, having sex earlier in life. And in a previous study, we looked at risky driving, so being pulled over for violations of the law and getting into automobile accidents. And finally, in this particular study, we also included measures of general delinquency, stealing, petty theft, strong-arming tactics to influence other people. And basically, we found that the kids who played more mature-rated and, as you said, risk-glorifying games were more likely to do all of those things compared to kids that played who didn't play those kinds of games, who played video games but didn't play those particular kinds of games.
Could you give us some examples of the type of games you're talking about?
So we, in asking about gameplay, we asked a couple of different questions. One had to do with, do your parents let you play these games? And that scale went from, no, they don't, to, yeah, all the time. And then we asked about three specific games that were popular at the time that the initial data were collected. That was Grand Theft Auto 3, which I think most people are familiar with. Essentially, you play an underworld thug going around stealing cars and working their way up the criminal underground. Manhunt, which many Americans aren't as familiar with, although it's been banned in Germany and Australia and Great Britain, which is basically you're being told by a psychotic to kill people in a variety of creative ways using chainsaws, sickles, plastic bags, and things like that. Then the third game was a more innocuous game, which was Spider-Man 2. I think most people are familiar with Spider-Man, where you're playing a superhero. We found that Spider-Man wasn't particularly predictive of anything. Spider-Man play wasn't. But the other measures that we had, particularly Grand Theft Auto, but also Manhunt, and the overall general question of whether you play mature-rated games, despite the fact that you aren't of age to play those games, those were predictive of pretty much all of the outcomes that we looked at. And again, that was the point of the study, that the association of these games with subsequent increases in deviant behavior is very broad, is not just limited to aggression. And if anything, in our study, although we found effects on subsequent aggressive behavior, the effects on some of the other measures, particularly alcohol use, were even stronger.
Why do you think there's this link?
Well, The traditional account of how these games have their influence is that you practice things in the game that then carry over into real life. So you practice being aggressive. You're rewarded for doing aggressive things. And then that, in a very straightforward learning kind of model, leads you to subsequently behave aggressively in real life. In particular, you start being suspicious of other people and just responding hostily to them. What we're arguing is that that may well be true, and that may well account for some of the effects, but that the character that you're playing in the game matters. The motives and intentions that you're enacting in the game matters. And if you're playing a character that essentially has antisocial values, like in Grand Theft Auto and Manhunt, to take two of the examples that we have, although a lot of these games have those kinds of bad characters, if you're playing a character like that, you're essentially being affected by the kinds of values that that character has in the game. So you're imagining yourself being this person. And as a consequence, the influence of the game on subsequent behavior is much broader and carries over to a variety of deviant kinds of behaviors like we're looking at. And the deviant behaviors, it's interesting to note, those cluster of teenage deviant behaviors, that was focused on in the late 1970s by Dick Jesser. So we pick up on that general behavioral deviance in adolescence looks like the particular behaviors that we're looking at.
You were studying teenagers. Do you think this carries over to adults?
You know, that's an excellent question. There's not a lot of literature on that. There's starting to be some studies on it. We're conducting a literature review now where we look at all of the longitudinal studies that have been related to video games. And what you can see there is that most of the researchers are focusing on teenagers, and I'm assuming that they think that, well, that's where most of the influence is going to be, or at least the teenagers are not supposed to be playing these games. They're mature-rated games, and some of them are extremely violent and gory, and so that may be distorting to teenagers. Of the few studies that have started to look at age differences, there does seem to be some evidence that it's more influential on young teens than it is older teens. And of the very few studies that I know of that have looked at adults, they haven't found effects.
Jay Hall, a professor at Dartmouth College. The study is published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Well, thank you for joining us today for our International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey, reporting to you from Washington.
This is Today in History. On August 11, 1786, Captain Francis Light formally took possession of what would be known as the British colony of Penang in Malaysia. It was Britain's first colony in Southeast Asia. On this day in 1919, American industrialist and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie died, leaving a fortune to cultural foundations and charities. Carnegie had come to America as a poor Scottish immigrant and later rose to become a successful industrialist, helping to found the United States Steel Corporation, America's largest steel company. In 1929, American George Herman Babe Ruth became the first baseball player to hit 500 home runs in his career. He broke the record during a game at League Park in Cleveland, Ohio. Today, more than 30 players have surpassed the milestone. On this day in 1952, Jordan's 16-year-old Crown Prince Hussein Ibn Talal was proclaimed king after his father was declared unfit to rule on grounds of mental illness. A key figure in the Arab-Israeli conflict, King Hussein recognized Israel in 1994, becoming the second Arab head of state to do so. The king died in 1999 and was succeeded by his eldest son. In 1965, on this date, rioting began in the Los Angeles neighborhood of Watts after a white police officer scuffled with a black motorist suspected of drunken driving. 5 days of violence left 34 people dead, hundreds injured, and thousands under arrest. On this day in 1987, Alan Greenspan was sworn in as the chairman of the U.S. Central Bank, known as the Federal Reserve. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is little doubt in the minds of the U.S. military and intelligence community that climate change can accelerate instability and serve as a catalyst for conflict. The National Climate Assessment, released by the White House, noted that the world's climate is already rapidly changing, said Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Development, Daniel Chu, before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Certain types of weather events are already occurring more frequently or intensely, including heat waves, heavy downpours, hurricanes, floods, and droughts. Glaciers and Arctic sea ice are melting at a relatively rapid rate, sea levels are rising, and oceans are becoming warmer and more acidic. Moreover, said Assistant Secretary Chu, scientists predict that some of these changes will increase in frequency, duration, and/or intensity over the next 100 years. Already, we see climate change exacerbated drought in the Middle East and Africa, which is contributing to conflicts over food and water. That, in turn, escalates long-standing regional and ethnic tensions, too often resulting in violence. In Asia, rising sea levels are putting at risk people and food supplies in vulnerable coastal regions, such as eastern India, Bangladesh, and much of the Mekong Delta, destroying livelihoods and dislocating residents. Such upheaval contributes to regional and economic instability and could create fertile recruiting ground for extremists. These developments could undermine already fragile governments that are unable to respond effectively or challenge currently stable governments, as well as increasing competition and tension between countries vying for limited resources, said Assistant Secretary Chu. These gaps in governance can create an avenue for extremist ideologies and the conditions that foster terrorism. Indeed, the latest U.S. Defense Department Quadrennial Defense Review, which is issued once every 4 years and is the agency's main public document describing the current doctrine of the United States military, drew a link between the effects of global warming and terrorism. Climate change is an inherently global problem, affecting the security, stability, and economy of all countries. And because the price of doing nothing far outweighs the costs of finding and investing in solutions now, the United States is ready and willing to work closely with all our allies, partners, and other countries across the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.